keep calming the mind. Any of those thoughts which we call doubt, they're hindrances, and they're going to hinder the mind entering jhana. So the mind should be wary enough of the hindrances at this stage. As soon as doubt arises, one suppresses it straight away and doesn't ask the question, is this a hindrance or is it not? So it doesn't encourage the hindrance by saying, is this a nimitta or is this not? One keeps the mind calming, calming, calming. And then that which one will see will become the mental object, will become the nimitta. This is a natural process of the mind which happens with all minds once we do this practice we call jhana meditation or samatha meditation. If you keep watching the breath from the very beginning to its end in this particular way and keep the mind sort of tending to calm, 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 the mental image will arise by itself. After a while you get to know that this is indeed a mental image. It will be different to every person in this room. The way that I look upon my mental image will not be the way that you will look upon yours. And that's why it does take a very skilled meditator to be able to teach others about nimittas and mental images. They are so personal. But you know, it is that which arises when the mind gets quiet enough that the physical feeling turns into the mental object. You will know. Another sign of this, the mental image, is that the mind is very peaceful. And it is a increase in the peace of the mind rather than a disturbance in the mind when the mental image comes up. And with that mental image will come the other important jhana factors of the Piti Sukha. And again, at this stage, my advice to you, and again this is not from the suttas, this is personal experience advice, do not at all be concerned which is pity and which is sukha. That will just giving rise to the hindrance of doubt again, and the mind will get restless and you'll lose it. From my experience at this particular stage, and even in the second jhana as well, pity sukha is indivisible. And you don't really know what is pity and what is sukha at this stage, and you can't know. The only time you really understand the difference between pity and sukha is when you've been in first jhana and you've been in second jhana and then you go into third. Because it's in third jhana where pity falls away. And what you're left with is sukha. And then you know what sukha is then, because it's an experience. And these are like mental things. And they're just so difficult to put into words. An experience, sort of, you know, in like a deep jhana. But you know, this is what sukha means. And when you know what sukha means, when it's devoid of its like constant companion, usually pity, then you also know what pity is. But the piti sukha will be delightful feelings. So it'll be a delightful state of mind. And it is actually that delightful state of mind which one should not be afraid of, one should not be scared of, one should not be wary of, because of all things it is that piti sukha which actually draws the person into jhanas. It is like the magnet which draws the attention even further in. It's the vitakka vichara, sort of, in the sense they've done their job. Once they get piti sukha strong enough for the mind to sort of be dragged in, willing or unwilling, into the mental object which becomes first jhana. That piti sukha is called paviveka sukha. It is dependent upon one being achieving seclusion from the world. And indeed one knows this because that state of even first jhana, the mind, as they say in Thai, jit luam, the mind has come together. It is self-contained, if you like, for want of a better word. And it's just not at all interested in the outer world. In fact, the outer world has a hard time even contacting the mind at this stage. You've withdrawn, you're inside. they say that like a sound can disturb one in first jhana, and that's very true if it's a loud sound. If it's a soft sound, that, you know, most of the time you wouldn't notice it at all. It has to be someone really sort of banging a door loud, or shouting, or someone blasting a horn. Just a little bird outside just tweeting, or, you know, or a person just walking slowly by you. You really wouldn't notice at all, because the mind is in itself. And it's in itself, and it's happy there. What's holding it there is the glue of piti-sukha. And that becomes the main object of first jhana, of piti-sukha, with vitakka and vichara, which is that piti-sukha is very strong. It is maintained. It is maintained still by the mind, vitakka and vichara in. The mind still moves back from that piti-sukha and forward to it again, back and forward, very slightly. Maybe you might describe it just like a light swabbing. Not really that still yet. Well, one only realizes it's not still once one has been into second jhana and knows what real stillness of the mind is, what real samadhi is. But at this particular stage, the mind automatically is still doing vitakka and vichara to keep its attention close by to piti-sukha. It can't go too far away. But the point being here is that that piti-sukha is sustained. The first jhana is not a state where piti-sukha rises and then disappears again. It is a sustained state of consciousness which should last for a reasonable length of time. And again, the more powerful the experience is, the longer one will stay in it. If it's a very short experience, sometimes you can't be sure whether it's a jhana or not. When it's a long experience, half an hour, a couple of hours, that's when you emerge afterwards, you've got no doubt at all that was a jhana and a strong one. And it gives you the confidence afterwards to know that you have indeed attained a jhana. 5-minute jhanas are just, you know, really uncertain. And in my experience, most of the time they're not jhanas. And so one has the piti-sukha, vitakka-vichara, ekagata, the sustaining of the attention on its object. One pointedness on the piti-sukha. That vitakka and vichara, the vitakka, the mind continually moving onto its object, the mind sees that as a hindrance. It's work. And what is work? Is a disturbance. And what is disturbance is what samatha is supposed to be eliminating. If that one understands from the very beginning this is a calming of the mind, a calming of all the sankharas, sort of a shutting down of activity, an abandoning of all busyness, then the mind will know that it's time to shut down vitakka and vichara. Know that Sariputta said that there is a jhana in which, like vitakka, is abandoned, and then vichara is still there. I was just thinking about this the other day, that some people call it the one and a half jhana, because they say when vitakka and vichara are completely abandoned, that's supposed to be like second jhana. But indeed, like when vichara is still there, it's more close to second jhana than it is to first jhana, because the mind is moving to that point. I mean, for vichara is like the mind having to hold the attention on the piti-sukha. But when the mind is holding it on there and it doesn't leave at all, the mind automatically will just give up vichara. If you're holding something on, then you're successful. You don't hold anymore. And when the mind has piti-sukha as its firm object, and the attention isn't moving away, then you do experience what one-pointedness means, and why one poetiness, even in English, is such a beautiful, exact description of second jhana. The mind is just at one point. All the attention is together. There's just one object in the mind. And that one object in the mind is there moment after moment after moment after moment after moment. It's as if like any chime has disappeared for a while and the world has stopped moving, the earth has stopped spinning, things have stopped coming and going, and it's just pure stillness in the mind. And a stillness not with somebody outside looking in, but the looking is right in the middle of what you're looking at. Complete one-pointedness. No object, no subject, just one oneness of mind. And that stillness, that strength, that power of the second jhana gives rise to this piti sukha, which is of a completely different order than the first jhana. And you realize that the piti sukha born of samadhi is so far superior than the piti sukha born of like renunciation of the five hindrances, the seclusion from the five sense world. That piti sukha of the second jhana is just so strong, and you feel you can sit in there for hours. Then really I can't see how anyone can get into second jhana and not sit for a long time. The deeper the jhana, I would say, the more time you would spend in there, because the quieter the mind is. There's less things in there to disturb and take you out. And if you know this, why on earth would anyone abandon piti sukha of second jhana, you know, sort of after 5 minutes? And what would cause that piti, what would be the cause of that samadhi breaking? I just don't really know. I can't imagine it. A second jhana should last for a long time. And a long time, like perfectly comfortable, without any intention or will to stay in a long time. This is a natural result, a natural part of the mind. When it gets absorbed to this degree, and it's enjoying itself so much, it just won't leave. And in a second jhana, there's no way where you could formulate will. There's no way where you can, because will is verbal, and there's no possibility of any words. There's no thought at all can occur in second jhana. Nothing can be done, you're just stuck there, and you're quite happily stuck. And it is that solidity of mind, that one-pointedness, that firmness of mind, just being like a ball, only a ball with no diameter, just at a point with no dimensions, always in the present moment, but without noticing the passage of time. You're one pointed in space and one pointed in time. So the whole universe, space and time, have disappeared for you. And you just blissed out in piti sukha. You're in like a mental perception here, and because mental perceptions have much more freedom than perceptions based on the physical realm, that you do get into like strange experiences. And this is one of those experiences, and it's a very peaceful, powerful, strong experience. And this is samadhi. This is the real first experience of samadhi in its fullness. That samadhi which is one-pointedness. As I said, it's the piti sukha born of samadhi, which is the salient feature of the second jhana. And then if one has entered this with the aspiration, with the chanda, to calm things down even more, then the mind can quieten down, settle down even more. We're dropping the piti and just having the sukha. So it was quite strange for me for many years why they describe third jhana as, what is it, the state where the Aryans declare this is like a happy abiding. I said, why don't they describe like first jhana, that's pretty happy, or second jhana? Especially, I mean, why don't they describe fourth jhana? And it's because this is the last state where there's such a concept called happiness. up like that, delight in the mind. And it's amazing to sort of to know what delight is. You know, when it's, you remove everything else and all that's left there is just delight, just by itself. And it's that, you know, in science, that's what one does to be able to know something, isolated from everything else. So you know it as it is, rather than as a relationship between two things. And then you know just what sukha is, what delight is, what happiness is, what, you know, is the basic building block of the mind. And of course that one stays in that a long time, because it is samadhi, it is one-pointedness. And the experience is that this is just all there is, just sukha, not changing, not wavering, not altering its size or its shape or its depth or its qualities at all, but just always there, always the same, moment after moment after moment, still in the timeless one-pointedness of mind. And if one is fortunate, that too will disappear, until there is just equanimity, just mind, neither happy nor unhappy. Just that which we call happiness, that concept, that perception has just completely been abandoned. One is a mind which just is. Just that one-pointed mental concept sustaining itself moment after moment for a long, 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 long time. And this is a mind which is refined, a mind which is still. It's just one concept maintaining itself. Quite often, like, a concept can't maintain itself very long in our mind. We think about it and it's just gone. And it is like that simile of just ringing a gong. If you've got a really big gong, one of these very fine ones from Japan, it might resonate for a long time. But you notice a change in the amplitude and maybe the pitch of the resonance with time. Imagine like a gong which, once you strike it, it carries on resonating, not changing at all, for 5 hours, 6 hours, and that's all you're aware of. And you get some idea of what like a jhana is like. No change. There's the mind one, still, perfectly content, equanimity. And it's because that this particular type of jhana, the fourth jhana, is just one concept jhana, that it can be a springboard for the arupa jhanas, which are also one concept jhanas. But really, I don't really have too much experience of those, so I don't want to talk about those. But these are the ways into jhanas. And when the mind has had its time in the jhana, for causes which you have to set up before you enter the jhana, you cannot set them up within the jhana. Certainly that a resolution made before the jhana can have the power to keep you in there for that particular length of time. If not, it will depend upon, quite usually, like the energy with which you enter the jhana. Usually the strength of wirya and chanda with which you enter the jhana will keep you in there for a short time or a long time. So when you exit from a jhana, again, the telltale signs it's been a jhana is one, that the passage of time has not really been noticed. You sat a long time, you didn't really know. The piti sukha as you emerge from a jhana is extremely strong and remains a coarse form of piti sukha, but just, you know, usually you're blissed out, watery-eyed. That lasts a long time. There is the clarity of the mind. The hindrances are still suppressed when you emerge from a jhana. They've, could similarly, they've just been smashed, knocked out, not cold. And it'd take them a long time to recover. The deeper the jhana, the longer you've stayed in that jhana, the longer the five hindrances will be smashed. They will come up again later on, but they're just out cold for many hours, sometimes many days. So one has that great clarity of the mind, and one knows what the Buddha said when he said the mind is malleable, workable, fit to be used. Once you know that the mind which has emerged from jhana, then you know why jhanas are really, really, really useful for the attainment of insight. Once you know what a mind which is workable is like, and you look at the other mind, which is, you know, the hindrances are there one moment, maybe they suppress them, they pop up again. It's just, you know, hardly workable at all. You know, you might think you're investigating anicca, dukkha, anatta. You might think that you really want to sort of find out the meaning of these things. But no, really, once you've experienced a decent jhana and emerged from it afterwards and know what the workable mind means, then you know for yourself, as an experience, why the Buddha practiced jhana before he became enlightened. Why he encouraged other monks to practice jhana, to get that mind in a workable state. And that's one of the telltale signs that a jhana has been attained. The mind is very, very workable. And practicing insight, if you just avert the mind to impermanence, impermanence, it just becomes such an easy thing to see. And you see it with such great depth. There's so much more than you've ever seen before outside of jhana experience. Dukkha, then you can see anatta. The mind is strong, it's workable. And if you want to remember past lives, you can just suggest to yourself, my earliest memory, take yourself back further and further and further. If you want to develop psychic powers with a workable mind, this is when one can. And then you can start to experience those things you read about in the suttas. And again, it gives so much joy and satta. You know, all these things the Buddha was talking about, they weren't just additions by later monks, they weren't just cultural additions, they weren't just like Indian fantasies of gullible people. But these are actually true. You've experienced them, you know what they're like and how they're achieved. But of course it's the use of that mind to attain insight into anicca, dukkha, anatta. As I said here before, the anicca is the easiest on the surface, and therefore that it can trick you into thinking you know it. Dukkha is the next easiest, and maybe you might convince yourself you know dukkha. But again, you only know dukkha if you're fully enlightened, so please don't be fooled that you can see dukkha very easily. But it's anatta which is by far the most interesting, because most people know quite surely they don't really understand anatta, unless they can come up and say to another monk, you know, that I'm sotapanna, knowing that if they're lying knowledgeably they're parajika and they have to take their robes off. There's a real test if you're really certain or sure or not. Unless you're prepared to do that, then you're not sotapanna. So it's because people are not that anatta becomes a very, very powerful, useful thing to contemplate when one emerges from jhana. And again, as I've taught here before, the way to investigate anatta, which I recommend here, is what do I take myself to be? Who do I perceive myself to be? And who do I conceive myself to be? The realm of perception and conception, the sannyas and the sankharas. What Ajahn Mahabur once said was the playground of the kilesas. What do I perceive myself to be? What do I conceive myself to be? And if you investigate with that tool, then that's in my experience and my advice is that you will have great success. So that this is my talk upon the way into jhana, what they feel like when one is inside of them. I'm sure that even though I've tried my best to be as accurate and as precise as possible, I'm sure that on this subject there will be many comments and also many questions. So I'm going to finish the talk now and invite any questions on the subject.
that as one keeps on watching the physical breath, this is at least one feels the mental breath parallel going on at the same time, and one takes a deliberate choice, the decision to switch, to drop the physical breath and to pay attention only to the mental breath. There is a point where they go parallel and they go together at the same time and one can select.
That's very true. If one knows what the mental image is, that's what one does. But the problem is that if one hasn't really achieved a jhana yet, then one is unsure what the mental image really is. And that uncertainty will sometimes be a great hindrance into the attainment of jhanas. That's why I was suggesting that for those who have not experience of jhanas, especially those who have uncertainty about what the mental image really is, instead of selecting something, just keep on watching the breath, calming that breath, until the mental image appears by itself, so clear, so sure, you can't mistake it. As many of the questions I've been asked about jhanas have been concerned with, like, is this the mental image or not the mental image? This is what I'm experiencing. Should I watch this? Should I watch something else? And if one is experienced and one knows what the mental image is, of course that's what one does. And if one is even more experienced, then one doesn't even watch the breath. One just averts the mental image of a jhana. You bring that concept into the mind, and then one can just bring up the concept, the nimitta, the mental nimitta of jhana. And if one is skilled, the mind will just go to that straight away, extremely pleasurable, then the mind will just go straight into a jhana. So really the question is answered by saying, by really it depends upon how well acquainted you are to the mental image, the nimitta. Does that make sense to you?
What you are saying is like one keep on watching the physical breath, and one has one keep on watching the physical breath, the mental breath will arise and replace the physical breath.
Yes, as long as
it's an automatic process.
It is an automatic process as long as you are calming the breath. As long as you're doing the fourth of the first tetrad of the Anapanasati Sutta. What is it? Kaya Pasambati. Like he calms the body of breath. Okay, yes, thank you.
So the mental breath can arise on stage 1 to 3.
The mental breath can arise at any stage. It really depends upon one's acquaintance with that nimitta. I can, for those people who have done a lot of meditation and know jhanas, once you start, just the mind just woof 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 and goes up to the mental nimitta straight away. So that mental nimitta is just triggered off, and depending on how well you know it, you don't even need to even start watching the breath as it goes in and goes out. I'm going to just go and avert that mental nimitta, bring it up into the mind. So certainly it can arise even before the first stage. So certainly in the first, second and the third of those tetrads can arise.
For thinking of the mental image arise progressively or just right?
It arises progressively, but the awareness of it might be sudden, especially in the sense of if it is a visual nimitta, like a light. There is a stage where the mind just will move to that, away from the physical breath, by itself, and you'll notice that. And for many people, that not really knowing the nimittas of the mind, they don't really know what to do with it, and so it disappears, and they go back to the physical breath, or they just alternate between the two, neither really sort of being strong. Sometimes the problem of reverting to that nimitta, that mental image, and then the mind hasn't got enough real peace, enough calmness, so So the mental limiter disappears, and so does the feeling of the breath. And the hindrances have just come up again. And you've lost both. So what I would suggest for those people who are not acquainted with the nimitta is even, like I've suggested this, and I've practiced it myself, is even to even suppress the mental nimitta and keep on the physical breath. I found this useful at times. If the mental image comes up too quickly, sometimes the mind isn't like stable enough, isn't peaceful enough to really be able to go and revert to that mental image and stay there long enough to enter a jhana. And so that, I've actually, just through a very gentle effort of will, kept the mind on the physical feeling of the breath. I've mentioned this to someone recently, and I just picked up a simile just on the top of my head, that when I was a young boy, I don't know if they have it these days, had these little cars with gear wheels inside, and you'd move them backwards and forwards, trying to pick up the speed inside the gear wheels, and then you'd let it go and it would move across the room. And that's like similar to getting like the momentum of peace going. If you let the car go too soon, it won't go very far. But if you keep it going really strong and resist the mental image coming up, and keep the mind very clearly and very firmly on the whole feeling of the breath from moment to moment, and then when you let that one go, when you revert to the mental image, and it sticks and stays there. Does that make sense to you? I haven't seen that in any books or heard that before. That's just like experience.
And then it comes back again. So this is really the refining of the breath, body can involve a certain amount of effort.
Yes, indeed. The being able to watch the whole breath body is all about continuity of attention. And quite often, if the breath disappears, it's not because it's replaced by the mental image, it's because that the hindrances have come up. And so one has to be careful there that one is maintaining, one is is building up the steps properly, one is building a house on a firm foundation rather than not building up too quickly. So to be able to keep that full awareness of the whole body of the breath, from the very beginning to its end, without interruption, with no interruption at all. So you really know the breath. And again, what you know is, the breath is breathing. And then, once the mental image is strong, and you revert to that, then, you don't... It is actually... This is an important point. The mental image is still the breath. It is the mind perceiving the breath. It's just an aspect of the breath. But it's looking at it a completely different way. Again, this is for the tape, because many of you know this simile I've used before. It's like a person just watching an apple. And when you first look at an apple, you see its shape, its size, all sorts of other things about it, such as its stalk, the different, and all sorts of other things. And it's as if after a while, just its shape, its size, the stalk, most things disappear, and all you're left with is just the colour. And that's the only thing left, just colour. And it may seem strange to many people, how can you just see colour rather than the thing being coloured? This is just what the mind does. Another example I used was of Lewis Carroll's Cheshire Cat. It's a brilliant simile of jhanas. I don't know where he got it from. He may have had jhana in a past life or something, I don't know. But like seeing a Cheshire Cat in the sky, and then according to this simile in, I think, Alice in Wonderland, or was it Alice with the Looking Glass? I think it was Alice with the Looking Glass. until the Cheshire Cat in the sky, and it started to disappear bit by bit. Its tail disappeared, its paws disappeared, its ears disappeared, and then its head disappeared, until all that was left was a smile, without a head, without lips, without teeth. Then of course you think, I mean, it's impossible, how can you have a smile without something to be smiling? But this is what the mind is like. You have just like the mental nimitta of the breath without the physical feeling. You have like just peace without, you know, anything being peaceful. These are like, you know, disembodied nimittas, are disembodied mental percepts. Yes, indeed. I mean, if that's like a way into the mental image.
If you know that it produces that,
yeah,
in the end.
For sure. Reword the question. As I understood the question, you were saying that as you watch the breathing, there becomes a physical sensation which becomes very strong. As you were saying this, you were pointing to the spot between the bottom of your nose and the upper lip. A physical feeling sort of becomes very strong there, much stronger than what you call a physical feeling of the breath, and then that gives rise to the mental image. And you were saying that is this a good idea to revert to that physical feeling, one pointed in space between the bottom of your nose and upper lip, instead of just watching the whole breath? Indeed, I say yes, to explain the answer even more, that feeling at the tip of the nose is indeed the stage where you're watching the whole breath. You're watching the whole breath as if it's at one point. You're like, just like the simile of the saw, which I think is in the Patisambhita Magga, where like the saw is moving but the carpenter is just watching the point on the wood where the saw is cutting it. And that's always said to be like similar to just watching the breath at the tip of the nose. And indeed, when I've said that I like disembody the feeling of the breath, when I've been doing breath meditation, I just know whether it's going in or going out. And I've, as an experiment, you know, when I've been able to know the whole breath without any interruption, just from the very beginning to its end, end to beginning, I've just asked myself, just where is that breath positioned? Because unless I ask myself that, just my own experience, you know, I really don't know, because I'm not really sort of even bothered with finding out or locating that breath in anywhere in my body. But whenever I've asked that, it's always been located between the bottom of my nose and my upper lip. It seems like quite naturally, whether you choose to watch it there or not, that's where it locates itself. So I don't actually watch the breath from the bottom of my nose. I just watch the breath as it goes in and goes out, and it settles down there by itself without my knowing it. That's it, yeah. That's it.
I always, very quickly, I come up with this feeling, which is, I actually don't, you know, we like to revert to the breath of the male. What is it? It's an intensity thing which I know in the park.
That's right, yes. Once one knows what the nimitta is, then one goes to that as soon as possible, and that means that one starts to get like control power over samadhi and over jhanas. Yeah, the tape is almost over now, so there's many questions, and they will not be on the rest of this tape. If one is interested in jhanas, then go and practice these things first of all. Once you practice everything which is on this tape, then you may ask questions.